Talking about millions of dollars.
What would you do if you had $1 million?
I'll tell you what I'd do, man. Two chicks at the same time, man.
We're living in a material world, and I am a material girl. Or boy.
Well, what about you now? What would you do?
Besides two chicks at the same time?
Oh, yeah.
Nothing.
Nothing, huh?
I would relax. I would sit on my ass all day. I would do nothing.
Well, you don't need $1 million to do nothing, man. Take a look at my cousin. He's broke, don't do
if I had $1 million.
Well, thanks, Action Jack. Talking about, we had burn on the board. SP Futures down 6.5. NASDAQ Futures down 27. This is a pimple on the butt of an elephant compared to the rally last week, so not much of a move down. Oil's up 250 to 97.92, so almost back to 100 bucks, but not there yet. We got treasuries up a little bit. Do we have Professor John Lee?
We do, I believe.
John, are you with us?
Well, I don't think so, Tom.
I think he's not there. Well, we have Jim Waller in studio. Oh. There he is. I heard an outpeep.
Yeah, no, I'm here. You guys didn't hear me?
No, we didn't. But now we do. So,
It's nice to wake up and the sun is out.
It happened maybe 3 weeks ago, a little bit, and now pretty much every morning. You know, you get to the point in this world where you say, what exactly do I pay for? Congress and retailers want to rebuild national parks. Now, of course, you would think we pay all these taxes. Turns out we need tolls on federal roads to pay for the parks. And we're going to have new fees on international visitors. Why don't we just tell people we don't want them coming here? Just say
well,
it.
Well, you know, Tom's, let's not forget, they don't have a big lobbying group, international visitors.
Yeah, they do.
So they're people that...
They have dollar votes.
Yeah, well, okay. In local representative elections for our House of Representatives, they don't have a big lobbying group. So it's, you know, this is the best thing that we do is that we tax people that we don't know or don't see. This goes back to our issue last week of saying, what's corruption? And, you know, having other people pay for your stuff.
Oh, yeah, well. Well, I mean, the idea of having federal roads operate around Washington, D.C. to pay for Glacier National Park is a little odd. If you're coming from another country and you raise the prices, you just don't show up. I mean, don't you want people here spending all the money?
I've heard two things. I mean, do we have people attending the World Cup or are people staying away?
What I understand, and this is a where's Larissa when I need her? The K-shaped recovery, the tickets, especially in New York City, are absolutely to the moon.
Wow.
Jimmy, what did we say? $6,000 a seat? Somebody's paying?
More than that.
More than that.
The most expensive ones went for $2 million, and our president, being his omnipotent one, said, you know, when they asked him about the prices, I wouldn't pay that. basically, just don't show up. Don't show up. Don't pay it.
Well, we know people that are friends of listeners. Hey, by the way, at 6:30 today, we're going to have a special appearance by a very popular Katie Mather, who was on before talking about all the research she was doing at like Vanderbilt in Minnesota and something on medical research, going through all the money and so forth. Well, now she's she's becoming a physician's assistant, and we'll be able to talk to her more about what's going on in that industry. One of our best guests. She's terrific. And so, anyway, we're going to have that at 6:30, so she'll be on when John will be on, and John Flanagan, everybody. It'll be a kind of a free-for-all, but that's okay. It's the idea of who pays for what, though, is really sort of amazing. But I think, you know, national parks, what is it? I have not been in a national park in a long time. What does it cost to go into one?
I have no idea. I haven't either.
Actually, when I went into... Yellowstone, we went in by snowmobile. I don't think it costs us anything in the wintertime because the park ranger's houses were under 3 feet of snow, so there was nobody in there. That was a long time ago. I bet they'd find a way to charge you now. You're saying what?
If there's anybody that works there.
Yeah, if there's anybody that works there anymore. But, I mean, our national parks are really national treasures. I knew guys that got laid off, outfitted a van, and went and saw a bunch of them, and they just had a great time. I mean, a lot of people do that. They thought Glacier was the most impressive, followed by Yellowstone, but they're all pretty awesome, I think. Jen, you did the Appalachian Trail.
I went to Glacier and Yellowstone. I drove through Yellowstone, but I actually backpacked back when that was the thing to do, through Glacier. And I must say that the stars were like nothing I had ever seen before. The sky was. The night sky.
Yeah, it's beautiful. When you did the Appalachian Trail, is that a national park, or what is that?
No, it goes through some national parks, and primarily national forests and a lot of private land. So it's maintained by a nonprofit organization, and, it was actually the trip of, I did it when I was with, you know, I did it with three other young guys. We were 16 years old. We did it for 3 weeks, and we did it on our own, no parents. And, you know, this is the amazing thing.
I don't think your dad would not have wanted to walk for 3 weeks. I knew him.
He was done with the outdoors. Believe me, after being in the military.
I can understand that.
Okay, Chief.
So my father actually drove from Ann Arbor, Michigan down to, I think it was Rock Springs Gap or something. It was in Virginia, and we hiked for 3 weeks going south. And it was I'm just amazed that our parents let 4 16-year-olds off on their own for 3 weeks. We hitchhiked everywhere. We found families. I mean, this is the important thing, is we would get off the trail after 5 or 6 days and go to a small town. We would always go to their local communities. Pool, and get in the pool, and take a shower and pay to get in and all that stuff. And this happened the first week we did it. A family, a girl that was a lifeguard there, she called her father up. Her father came over to meet us. He took us in. We stayed there for 3 days. strange young men for 3 days.
Well, can you imagine even hitchhiking today? Nobody would do that.
Then we, at the end, we hitchhiked to Virginia Beach and met another family that we stayed with. It was ridiculous. But, you thought nothing of it. That was just, that was just the world we lived in. It was great.
Well, it was the guy, our friend of the show, Bill Moriarty, who passed a few weeks ago. I was thinking last night about what it was like when we were young, and he and another buddy of mine would go on 115th Street, and they would just hitchhike every morning to school. And every day, every week, the principal would say, anybody caught hitchhiking is like going to be expelled. And I go, who picks you guys up every morning? Oh, one of the teachers. It was kind of a different, simpler sort of, so I'm not saying better, but just kind of a simpler sort of world. You didn't worry about stuff like that. I know people that hitchhiked from like Western Illinois to Notre Dame. Can you imagine doing it now?
I hitchhiked, Jesus, everywhere. We were always hitchhiking. When we were on our adventures out in the West Coast and all that stuff.
Well, it was
always a group of guys. One guy had, and we were, somebody had read a book or watched a movie about, climbing something. So we found some hill that we were going to climb, pretend we were mountaineers. It was a very idyllic childhood, actually.
What was the song? I came across a child of God. He was hitchhiking up to the farm for Woodstock.
A lot of people did.
Yeah.
And then they went up there, and all it did was rain. But anyway, John, we got the president heading to China this week. I'm not so sure exactly what the plan of that is. It seems like both sides are taking pot shots at each other, and it seems like kind of an odd time to visit. But what's the scoop on that from the other side of the world? Have you talked to anybody?
Well, yeah. I mean, people. Well, the Chinese are convinced now that we are a declining power. And, they've said that, of course, China is not having a great run on its own. So the Chinese are convinced that we're a declining power and we need to be managed, quote unquote. The So they're from a military standpoint, because, you know, I mean, they've really, of course, are the peer threat. Someone says near peer, but I think they're a peer threat. And I made this comment before that, you know, we can dance around the Taiwan issue all we want, but in my opinion, since 80% of the high-end ships in the world are made in Taiwan, there's no way we will ever allow China to control that. I mean, look what we do when we want oil.
Well, I mean, we don't. We get this idea that we don't want anybody to control anything, so we're going to conquer the damn world. Well, at some point, we're going to run out of gas here, or we're going to run out of motivation. And I think we're running out of motivation right now. I mean, I don't see us invading Greenland or Cuba or being.
People are tired of this crap. Because there's this war on right now. And because they view that Trump is not going to be as powerful as he was, because, you know, odds are he'll lose at least the House. They view him as a wounded, you know, they view us as being a wounded entity that just has to be managed. They have no respect. I mean, and this, it goes across all facets. I mean, make no mistake, the Chinese. So I was listening to, what's his name, Galloway, Professor Galloway. And he said, you know, just think what would happen if the Chinese and the U.S. work together. Chinese will never work together with anybody. The Chinese have a win-lose mentality. They're a mercantilist, imperial power. So, I mean, let's just realize what they are. And in 2017, they publicly announced that they're going to supplant us as the hegemon. So they need some real finesse in managing, and we just do not have that ability right now. What are their strengths?
I mean, they cut a deal with Venezuela.
The economy is their strength.
But they cut a deal with Venezuela, and it was a horse bleep deal. And they gave them money and never got the oil. I mean, I don't see them having a deal that's worked out for them any place. Have you?
No, they haven't. I mean, you know, so then on the upside, years ago, back when I was at Accenture, and, you know, we had Henry Kissinger come and talk to the partners. And he said, you know, the best foreign policy analysts I ever met were in the longest term thinking were the Chinese. Well, you know, when your closest ally is Russia, and, you know, you're propping up Burma, and you've pissed off, you know, Japan and South Korea and Vietnam, and they'll all officially stay neutral, except for Japan. You know, your other allies, Iran. But these are not great foreign policy successes.
Well, no.
And the other one, where they have been successful is in Africa, that we've ignored. But what do you get out of Africa?
I mean, it's just, I understand where you're coming from and the drive of the people up top, but they seem to be also, and we are to a certain extent here, they're leaving their population way behind. I mean, everybody's in debt. Everybody's paying mortgages on places they can't even live. I mean, how far can they go pushing their...
I'm not saying that, but they do have fundamental strengths. They have a massive, I mean, they're... If their middle class goes down by 10 or 20% by their standards, their middle class is bigger than the population of the United States. And somebody here on the call, we were talking about that they don't innovate in China. They do innovate in China. They're hardworking people. They're very adept, highly, you know, and the education level's going up. So I'll admit I have a fondness for China. I actually love the country. I hate the government, but love the country.
Well, I mean, I think
so
when you
look
at
their own issues, but you know, they usually overplay their hand. You know, listen to us talk when it comes to foreign policy, because down deep, people realize, you know, they never have signed an agreement that they want to live up to, and that they have. And the biggest examples are Hong Kong, okay, and also Taiwan, because they did sign agreements there. So I don't even know why Trump is going.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I don't understand why he's even going.
I think they want to reduce the tension right now because he does have his hands full with his little forever war.
Well, I mean, I think our problems here, to a certain extent, are internal. I mean, we're broke. I mean,
they're all.
But I'm saying China's worse off. I mean, they're worse off.
I'm not sure about that.
Well, sure they are.
Well Chief, they say that China's selling their reserves. They're selling oil. They're selling, you know, LG.
They have a bigger trade surplus than they ever have had. So how is...
They're open for business.
They have massive amounts of private debt. They're huge. We don't have whole cities here that aren't occupied that people are paying mortgages on.
Yeah, they do have that, but that is not... You're not going to drive through the countryside of China and every other city is that way. They do have those things, Jimmy and Tom.
Well, they have no oil. They have no oil. That's a problem.
No, they have reserves. Yeah, they're selling their oil.
I'm saying they don't have a lot of the natural resources.
Well, okay, let's just put it this way. I think their economy is in probably... We're both in equally dire straits to a certain extent from an economic standpoint. Excuse me.
What do you mean? All you gotta do is have Micron stock. You're on Fat Island.
Yeah, I know. Well, I don't. So there's the Chinese view, then there's the Southeast, and then there's the Asia view. And, you know, you go through. And they've managed, it is virulently, they use propaganda to no small degree. I mean, you guys all know this. The anti-Japanese propaganda and the anti-U.S. propaganda. I was astounded when I went through Hong Kong my last trip, which was about a month ago.
Yeah, who were they learning from?
6 weeks ago. Yeah, so it's... I don't know why he's there. I think that it's, you know, it is a... I don't think either country is in a position to make any fundamental change to the relationship at this point. Trump is Trump is coming in from a position of weakness. But China doesn't have a lot of cards on the table either. So people are just...
Well, his biggest position is he's up the price of their energy dramatically.
Yeah, so the other thing too is people, you know, our traditional allies are trading very cautiously around the U.S. right now. And the people that were non-aligned are distancing themselves. You know, they're trying to make this whole, you know, the global South, which I think is kind of a ridiculous concept. You know, Indonesia and India and so forth, trying to become leaders of the global South or the third world. And I don't see that going anywhere because everyone has got their self-interest.
Well, Trump's self-interest are actually to
decision making.
I don't see them. To me, everything is kind of coming unglued a little bit. What's the guy in Britain? His party just lost a big election. Anybody happy with anybody? It doesn't appear to be.
No, I mean, I'll tell you what, this guy Farage, he is a far right piece of work. He is really something.
Well, we seem like we're getting to the point where anybody who's in there, nobody wants, and you get the new party in there, and they don't like them either. So it's we're having economic issues kind of all over the place.
I want to talk about something next week because I know we've got a guest coming on in 5 or 8 minutes. I'm reading a book called The Achilles Trap, and it's a new podcast called The Rest is Classified. And it talks about the run-up to the Iraq invasion, when Hussein was toppled.
Which one? The second one?
The second one, he was toppled. Okay. And so the history starts at the end of the first Iraq war, and it chronicles what happens. And I must tell you guys, it's the most fascinating thing I've ever read. Because everything that I know is, you know, that we game the intelligence. And to a certain extent, that's true.
Well, there were no weapons of mass destruction, but there was oil.
So actually, it was like this, guys. There were. He had a very advanced chemical and biological program, and he did have a nuclear program, and it was, you know, they were not, they were further than we thought they were. They were nowhere close to having a bomb, make no mistake. But what he decided to do, because he was so focused on getting rid of sanctions, is that before the UN inspectors came in, because he thought that they would be nothing but CIA spies. And he was correct. They were nothing but, half of them were nothing but CIA spies. He destroyed all of his chemical and biological weapons, and they dismantled the entire nuclear program, and he never told anybody. He did it in secret. And the reason he did it in secret was that he did not want the Iranians to know that he did not have weapons of mass destruction, or the Israelis.
Well, he was a brutal guy. He was quite a character.
Yeah, so you know, we played this story forward here, and he said, look, let all the UN inspectors come in, and they won't find anything, so I'll get my sanctions lifted. Well, UN inspectors come in, they can't find anything. They know there was something out there. They're hearing little tidbits here and little tidbits there, and so they're running around Iraq, can't find anything. So the distrust level, and by the way, you combine that with we had very, very little human intelligence. Actually, people that
we had no intelligence in the leaders either. Well, yeah, they wanted oil.
And so it was a fascinating story. I'd recommend it to anybody. The book's called The Achilles Trap.
Well, do we have Mr. Flanagan? Do we have Mr. Flanagan?
We do right now.
You do.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Do we have, is Katie piled in yet?
Not yet, no.
When she does, let us know.
Well, AI has told us, speaking of the Glacier National Park, it is $35 a car, $30 a motorcycle, $20 to hike in, and if you are not a U.S. citizen, you have to pay $100 more. And here's something for you, Chief. It is cashless. They don't take cash.
Not a U.S. citizen, so...
But that's a question. Glacier National Park actually is in both countries, Canada
and the
U.S.
So you need a passport to get in?
I don't know. I'm just reading with AI. Glacier National
Park, but I mean, your driver's license is not a proof of your citizenship.
It just said non-U.S. citizens must pay an additional...
$100. That's right. They put that in place a while ago.
That's so ignorant, I can't. So how do you prove you're a citizen?
Well, isn't that part of the SAVE Act? Or SAFE Act?
What? I'm saying you don't... I don't know what it is, but it sounds like an idiot act to me, but... How do they know you're a citizen? They bring a birth certificate or a park?
No, by the language you speak. You're not speaking English.
All right.
You're not a U.S. citizen.
I get it. but you can't ever say that any of this is racist, because that would be wrong, right? By the way, Micron's up another $46. We're talking about almost $400 billion in market cap in 3 weeks on a stock. That's pretty incredible.
That's pretty incredible.
And we've got Intel doing the same thing. We've got... AMD doing the same thing, and all these stocks, every nickel we spend going forward is going to go toward chips. I don't know if you knew that or not, but that's where they're all heading. Not to mention, well, Nvidia, where's Nvidia? Nvidia's actually down 80 cents, so it'll be up. I mean, this is like 1999 all over again. This is crazy stuff. Mr. Flanagan, what's up with you?
Oh, this typical Monday morning. How are you guys?
Well, not totally typical. We should have Katie on board in a few minutes. So we talk about the medical area. She's now becoming a physician's assistant, I think, at Yale or someplace. I mean, someplace. I mean, Katie's high end. But the last time we talked a lot about she was in research, and we talked about how that money went back and forth and who controls the patents and everything. And so, John, whatever you feel like asking her, I mean, she's got a lot of the answers.
Well, I'm going to tell you, my daughter is in research, molecular biology. And I think I've made this comment before. I didn't realize just how political academia was.
Oh, God, yeah.
Compared to our corporate world. And what pisses her off, and I'm not going to say her name or where she's working, is that, you know, the principal researchers, the ones that own the lab, they basically just use all the staff for new products, you know, for and then the owners, then the principals go form separate companies, and the people that did all the work don't get anything.
Well, that's what Katie mentioned. You actually have to sign an agreement that nothing you do there is,
yeah,
is your profit, it's theirs.
So that does not lead to people wanting to stay in the industry, stay, you know, doing what's the most important thing we could probably are doing, basic research.
Well, the last time she was on, to summarize it a little bit, because we'll talk about something different today, she was going through, say, I think the example I used was, I don't know why I used it, but say sickle cell anemia. If Stocks and Jacks wanted to send $2 million to research for sickle cell, well, there's some money, okay? Then you might have a doctor or two or a team that's doing some research at some place. They might get some money from government. And so she says every one of these things, these research things, have like their own cost center. Because, I mean, when you write the check for $1 million, you want to get it to that group. You don't want to send it to Minnesota or Vanderbilt or Illinois. I mean, you want to make sure it gets there. And these individual research people, the doctors or whatever, if they can apply for federal grant or state grant, mostly federal, that research module gets the money. And maybe Northwestern or somebody lobs a overhead on the people of, you know, 200% or 300%. So they actually make money on the deal because it's their facility, right? So if we give somebody, you know, $2 million and it's at, you know, XYZ hospital or university, the university is going to charge an overhead. So they get their dough. So now all of a sudden there's a breakthrough in sickle cell group. Well, if Katie's working on it, she doesn't get anything. We don't get anything. The university maybe gets something. Doctor might, but if you sell it out as a patent to some company, now the company has the patent, even though they didn't do anything. I mean, it's a total circle jerk. I mean, and how this all works out. I mean, it's really... And then somebody gets 17 years to charge people that have sickle cell, you know, more money than God. And insurance will pay for it. And it really is a messed up industry to in any extent. I mean,
I was astounded as a friend of mine who was a physician, retired, and both, you know, one daughter became a doctor, and then his son married a doctor, and so they're doing research, you know, and the daughter that married a doctor, he does research, and he was echoing what you were saying. He was like, you know, a lot of this research money the institutions are putting just massive overhead charges onto. He said the same thing.
They make money no matter what happens, and but you have to, it has to be somewhere. It's almost like you'd, you know, if people really wanted to put money together, they'd put it for a research facility, and nobody could put an overhead on it. But then, it's, you know, it. But everybody thinks that, like, you know, companies are doing all this stuff. They're doing some. A lot of it's being done by third parties, and the patents pile out, and all of a sudden, you know, somebody's making a fortune on a deal that had nothing to do with it. I would, Katie says she did not get a link, Matt. So we got to send her a link. She's listening as we're talking about her. Matt, are you there?
Yes, I am. Sending a link right now.
All right, and so she'll pile in. But yeah, when she comes on, she'll straighten us all out here. But the whole industry, plus I want to ask her now. There's some people I know that have some health issues. God's sake, you want to see a specialist? It's like 2 months.
I mean, it's really increased a lot.
Are we trying to kill off the sick people, or what are we doing? I mean, it seems like that's the go. Jim, Mr. Flanagan, some family members and so forth, unfortunately, have issues, and to try and get in to see these people, it's really scary.
Oh yeah, I mean, when I was trying to get a hearing test last year, the earliest I could get it was 7 months. You know, I thought, well, are there that many people losing their hearing, clogging the arteries of the medical system? I don't know. It just seemed kind of ridiculous.
It took you 7 months?
7 months, yeah.
My God.
I don't... Yeah,
this is, you know, this is after I come forward to my, you know, my regular physician saying I got something going on in my hearing. And I think maybe I should see a specialist. And he said, sure. And he gave, you know, I got a referral. We'll talk to that office. Yeah, 7 months. First appointment.
I don't... when I had to get an MRI 2 years ago. And a Northwestern people, they said, okay, Northwestern had like five spots. Every one of them was full. I don't know how much they wanted to charge. You know, a boatload was like $5,000 or something, maybe more. And then I started digging further into it. There's independent places that are like 500 or 1,000. And there's even places where you can say, gee, I twisted my knee playing softball last night. You can walk in. You don't even have a... you don't even need a prescription. They'll for $250. They just give an MRI, and then they'll read it for you. I mean, it's stunning the range depending on whether insurance will pay for it or not, if it's recommended. I mean, it's so. But I have to believe, Jen. I don't know this. I mean, you probably did more of this, but that if you just, you know, Googled hearing test, that you'd have found someplace somewhere that would just give you hearing tests.
Oh, yeah, they, you know, a study, somebody, I get these mailings sometimes, you know, do you have hearing loss? Do you think you have trouble? You know, here, we get money from some research group or whatever. Make an appointment, you know, give you this test, you know, if you need a prescription for hearing aids, we can do that too. So there are competitors, and I think there should be competition, certainly. I just don't understand how the mainline medical system is so glutted, unless there really is rationing going on. This is part of the, I don't know if it's the legacy of Obamacare, that this was the intent all along to restrict access, because it certainly has ended up that way. But
I don't think you can blame this on Obama. I don't know where you put the blame, but
no, I mean, by not to blame anybody personally, but it's part of the same development. I mean, I really think that, you know, this was probably a lot of the thinking behind Obamacare, that, you know, that there were a lot of people who needed care who had no money to pay for it, no insurance, no nothing. And we had to find some way of making people, you know, pay more and to get the care spread around. Well, of course, that really starts, you know, denying care to a lot of people who do need it, just because you got more people now who think they have access to the system. So.
Well, you have people who, they would rather, you know, I'm not saying they shouldn't, they would rather wait 5 months and have insurance pay $5,000 than pay $250 themselves, because they don't have the $250. It's not like they're
right. Oh,
you know, it's a pretty scary situation in that regard. And you know, the idea that, you know, insurance is the know-all and giver of all of this whole mess is really not it's not a good situation. I don't know how you.
And that's the biggest rationing problem with care, is the insurance end of it, really.
Yeah, and they. You know, when you think about how all this stuff works or doesn't work, it's pretty scary. The hey, Matt, I got it right here. Matt.
Yeah.
Still trying to get Katie's Zoom stuff so she can pile in, but yeah, I mean it's really something when you think of the insurance mess on this whole thing and how people in co-pays. I mean, one of the you guys have told this story before, but the gentleman here in the building had, I was going to say a simple hernia, nothing simple if it's on you, right? But just one, it wasn't like a double or triple or anything. You know, again, that, if it's on you, it's simple, but it's not. And he says to me, what should I do? This is in February of whatever year it was, maybe 3 years ago. Now, his deductible for his horse bleep insurance policy is like $6,000 or something. So they wanted to send him to a place that was the hernia was going to be like $7,000 or $8,000 or $10,000 or something. And but then he has the other opportunity was to go to a place where they just did the hernia and they had just as many good a reputation. I think the whole thing was $2,200 or something for the whole deal, or maybe $2,500. And he says, what should I do? And I, you know, I can still do this, put pen to paper. You know what, guys? I couldn't come up with an answer. They had the numbers so tight. On the one hand, if you paid the deductible and it's only February, well, then if, you know, your son sprains an ankle or something in soccer, then you don't have to pay anymore. So if it, I got to the point where if it was November or October, you were better off paying for it yourself, but in February you were better off paying a deductible and paying essentially three times as much for the surgery. You know what? That sucks. And I said, you know, I think you should pay the $5,000. I mean, where was I wrong? I mean, you can't make the bet that the whole rest of the year you're not going to do anything, right, when you got a family.
No.
But, I mean, how could ever paying $7,500 instead of $2,500 be the better deal? I mean, it's insane, isn't it? It's not exactly the perfect competition that Milton Friedman would have described, would it?
No.
I don't know what it is, but it's weird, right?
As you say, it's not perfect competition.
No, it's no competition, essentially.
Yeah.
I mean, and the weird part is it's not just we have people in office that don't believe they have to, you know, kind of go by any rules. But then again, they're just reflecting society. I mean, how many times, a couple times, Supreme Court has said hospitals cannot charge different stuff to different people. Yet they do. They don't pay attention. And the executive branch is supposed to enforce these things. And what do? It's not just him. Biden didn't. Obama didn't. Trump one didn't. They just let nobody challenges any of this stuff. And kind of here's where we are.
How's it going?
Hey, how are you?
I'm like, I'm good. How are you?
We finally got you in. All right, I've been talking about you. Catch everybody up. You were our girl in research. And by the way, John Lee, who's on the call with us, his daughter is doing. Where's she, John? She's a.
She's out of Northern California, and so she's with a private research institute out there. She's now applying. She's now going to apply this fall to PhD programs. So. Indentured servitude is still alive, as I'm sure you're very well aware of.
Yes.
Katie, what's the difference between a private research place and like a Vanderbilt or Northwestern or Minnesota like that?
Well, so they all have private money. So yeah. I don't want to say the name of the place, but they view themselves as the West Coast Broad Institute, if that makes any sense at all. So basically it's a research institute that's under one of the large universities out there that begins with an S, and it's all privately funded. So, Tom, I may have said this to you before, Tom and Jimmy, that you walk in and think you're going on to a science fiction movie set. Everything is white. The ceilings are, 15 feet high. It is rows upon rows of enclosed research benches, with all the pipettes and everything that you're doing, because this is molecular biology. I mean, and it's huge. It's massive. 300, I think they have 300 to 400 people there. And so I finally turned to them once and I said, that was a family day. I said, where's the funding for this come from? And I was expecting to say, well, National, Science Institute or nice sign that, whatever, I think it was an institute or foundation. And they just looked and said, oh no, this is all privately funded. It's from Northern, it's from the Bay Area technology billionaires. And I was astounded. It's just, but then, Katie, as I was saying earlier, that then my daughter has gotten exposed to some of the politics in these research institutes. And that's a little, I was going to say, that's a reality wake-up call. So,
I think the university you're talking about is the same one Katie gave a presentation to. Just saying, Katie, how do you separate all this out? I mean, what if this place finds a cure for, God knows what? Who owns it?
So yeah, that is. For private research, I'm not exactly sure, but when I was doing research, it was funded by the NIH, and that is really owned by who creates. So you have like a principal investigator who's the head of the study, and if they create any like proprietary information that hasn't been done before or studied and say they have like one product, then they're the ones who have say in that and benefit from it. But it's all the people who work under that principal investigator. You really just benefit through like publications and getting paid like you normally do. So really you can't make an insane amount of money unless you're the one coming up with the novel idea of it, which is why a lot of people go from academia to industry, because you make significantly more money. Since academia, it's kind of a lot slower because you have to go through the NIH and the funding is a lot slower and more methodical. And then once you get to industry, everything is a lot more expedited, and you can do things at a much larger scale much faster. So that's, in the world of research, people in academia hate industry because it's has the reputation of being all about money, but then you make more money and you can do things faster. So it's like a weird mix of where you want to be.
I mean, for example, Lauren could probably make 25% more money.
Oh, yeah.
And in 25% at least more money on an annual basis. Now, when you're a, I think it's gone up since then, but so if you're a research associate and you're making $75,000 in the Bay Area, well, I mean, that's real money.
And that's why a lot of people, that's what they call it, like the dark side. Like you leave academic research and go to the dark side because they can get you because they have so much higher money that they can offer.
Well, Katie, why these things that are set up for like individual research projects, why aren't they set up as like a regular company where if it succeeds, they're shareholders, everybody's got their piece, and everybody can be a part of it? Why does it have to be sort of cloak and dagger like you're sort of describing?
I'm not sure the motive, but it does have a lot to do with the grants and like who directly applies for the grants. So it's like a ton of people are helping out on the study, but then it all started with one submission to the NIH, and that's submitted by one person, the principal investigator. So it's like technically that person is responsible for all of the intellectual work behind it and the reasoning. And then once you get that grant, then you can hire all the people to work with you. So it's like the chicken before the egg. So that person's there before everyone else, which is kind of unfortunate. But like, for example, our research that we did was using nicotine patches as a treatment for memory and depression in older adults. And I mean, we didn't invent the nicotine patch, but we came up with the idea to use it for treatment for both of those things. So it's like in industry, a lot of them are inventing these revolutionary products, or like in biomedical engineering, and they get huge bucks out of that. But it's more so like using information and ideas to come up with novel things instead of like products, at least for like where I've been.
Well, you could have been young lady who
I just wanted to add one thing in there. She's right on in the sense that the principal is the person who really sets up the separate company. So he has research and, I don't know, plug the gap here, or the whole name something, right? I don't know, enzyme synthesis, blah, blah, blah. And it was his idea usually, maybe. But he's the one that spins off the company, the principal. You know, he will spin off a company if this does come through. And what happens is, as Katie said, you get to write the paper, you get to be, and so forth. So it helps your career from that standpoint.
Katie, you know, so much money the lady made with, God, what was the name of that firm, guys? The EpiPen fiasco? What was her name?
Don't know.
The very attractive blonde lady who, in her 30s, and she got all these people on the board. Well, she invented, even though you mentioned the nicotine patch, the EpiPen's been around forever. It was actually invented by the Army. And she put a new cap on it, got a patent, and was charging $600 a throw and demanding they'd be in every classroom in the country. You guys could have done that with a nicotine patch. Put a different color coating on it, and off you went.
Yeah, I guess. But yeah, that is the key. If you have the patent, I mean, then you're fine. But
okay, so what's Katie doing now? It's a new Are you in Yale? Where are you?
No, so I'm going there. I start in August, so I'm not really doing anything too crazy at this moment, but I'm about to go there for PA school, so physician assistant.
Now, is that going to be, you've left the research behind, this is all new, or are you kind of combining the two?
Well, yeah, I'm kind of combining the two, so that's why I really liked their program, because they have a really big focus on research. So one part of the program is just research, and then obviously the other part is like the PA program normally is, but lots of times in school that they're not like usually integrated, and a lot of times generally PAs aren't really found in research, but I really liked that Yale like really embraces that.
What specific stuff is Yale doing research on? Do you have any idea what you'd be involved in?
Oh gosh, like literally everything. Part of the reason why I want to go there and wanted to go there in the first place is because they have this fellowship where that I want to do where I could, so then I would be in control, so I could pick any
then
research.
You'll be the principal. Yeah, you'll be the principal. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
Exactly. Then I could pick any research topic that I wanted to do, write a proposal for it, get funding, and then I would be able to go live and work in whatever country for like 3 to 4 months and do this research and then publish it. And they give you funding to like go there and travel and live there.
So Katie, is this like a fellowship?
Yeah. So okay. That's like a huge reason why I wanted to go. So that, like a lot of people who do that say, I mean, it sounds like it, but like it's incredibly rewarding, and there's a lot of like huge medical breakthroughs that actually come through with that, since you have to do it in a low income country that's medically underserved. So a lot of people go to like South America or Africa. So that's something that I really, really want to do.
You want to go someplace that's safe.
Yeah, that's what my family said.
we've kind of grown attached to you. We don't want to hear about some kidnapping somewhere.
I know. They send a faculty member with you, so at least that.
Well, there's a lot of protection.
Yeah.
We had a yeah. young lady in, we were trying to figure out St. Patrick's Day. They all end up banging on my dorm room door at 7 in the morning because they knew we had a keg and they were demanding we tap it. Anyway, one of the ladies, Marianne McCarthy, very Irish, you know the kind, red hair, she joins the Peace Corps. And she's over in Africa, and she finds out that red-haired girls have a huge bounty on them if they get kidnapped, so she immediately quit the Peace Corps.
Oh, jeez.
she's like, I'm in it, but I'm not in it for that much. So now you're going, and this is, what level is this? Is this PhD? I mean,
it's a master's program, but I would eventually like to still get, like, a doctorate after this, but a lot of people, like, then go on to, like, publish their dissertations, and, yeah.
So do you see yourself in academia, obviously you like it there. I mean, now what's the jump? When is, you know, Lily or somebody going to say, hey, we need this Katie girl, and comes and tries to grab you, then what?
I don't know, but I honestly don't see myself in academia long term. I see myself working at, like, a large medical center and then doing research there. But like
getting
mostly
private funding for research or NIH.
Yeah, well, yeah, mostly I do want to focus on like seeing patients, and I also really like surgery, so that's why I want to go into this. So I want to do that mainly, and then also like do research on the side. Or some PAs and like physicians obviously are involved in consultants too, for like research consultants. So I could see myself doing that maybe in the future, but I'm not sure. I mainly want to do like stuff directly with patients.
Where's all these kind of forks in the road? I'll be Yogi. When you see a fork in the road, take it. One of the ladies, actually, she bartenders one night a week downstairs. What's she, Jimmy? She's a heart surgeon, PA. Whenever there's a heart surgery at Mount Sinai, she's in there.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what I didn't realize. So I debated med school and getting a PhD for such a long time. And then once I was at Vanderbilt, that's when I started shadowing in the OR and seeing surgeries. And I noticed that PAs were right there alongside the surgeons, and they are scrubbing in. You can, like, I saw a PA in neurosurgery, and she was screwing into the skull, putting in the device in the brain. Like, I didn't realize how much you could do, and you're trained to have all that hands-on role in surgery, and you're under the physician at the end of the day, but you're still there doing a huge part of the surgery. And I know, like, in cardiothoracic surgery, you since there's, like, especially in complex surgeries, there's so many parts to the surgery that the doctor just can't physically do it all. So the PAs, like, harvest the veins and arteries. And so once I saw that, I was like, oh, wow, this is amazing. You don't have to do a super long residency, and you can be right in there with the action, having, like, a huge role in patients. And I heard you guys talking earlier about access to healthcare is super difficult, and that's one of the main goals of the PA profession when it was created. It was actually founded at Duke first in the military because there was a shortage of physicians. So PAs were made to help bridge the gap basically between a lack of healthcare providers. So that's really what their original purpose was to help people get in if they had bigger wait times to see a provider if the physician wasn't available right away.
Hey, Katie, I had heard once from a doctor that it was the PAs that were also one of the things that helped create them were these combat medics that were coming back from Vietnam, and they wanted to, you know, keep them in the healthcare profession, and this was a good way to do that. Does that resonate at all? Did you ever hear that urban legend?
Not that exactly, but I do know that that's where it all started, like, in the military, where PAs came to existence. And then they realized, like, oh, wow, this is super helpful, and a need in healthcare is being met. And so, yeah, that's why it continued to grow. And even a lot of schools are getting more who don't have PA schools. There's a lot more in development, too, since especially, like, in rural settings, access to healthcare is really difficult. So there's a big push for PAs to go into rural medicine, which personally, I do not want to do that. But yeah, it is really helpful, though.
Well, you find it. We have one of the ladies who comes on the show. I don't know if you've listened in at all, Katie's. She, you know, we don't talk about it. You know, Diane Kelly.
You met her. Yeah.
Oh, you know, she knows everything there is to know about the veterans' homes, right? And and, you know, just the access to everybody is and that's why through Fisher House, you know what they do, they take care of the families. Yeah. By the way, the Fisher House thing Friday night was very nice. We had mentioned it in the air. We had a nice group from here that went, but just the idea. I mean, everybody thinks if you live in Chicago and you've had pretty much a Cadillac plan your whole life and you know physicians, and if something's wrong, you can always manage to weasel your way into somebody who's a specialist. The rest of the world is not like that. I mean, if you've got if you're not near a university or someplace, and you're in, you know, southern Illinois, and you've got a heart rhythm problem or some kind of a cancer issue, by the time you get to see somebody, you might be dead. I mean, it really is. It's horrible in terms of access.
Is horrible. Yeah, especially, depending on where you live. Like, I would see it even in Nashville. Like, we would have people at Vanderbilt coming from, like, Kentucky, Alabama, Mississippi.
Jeez.
And they were so
Mississippi?
Thankful. Oh, yeah. People came, like, even from Florida. Like, it was really crazy. Wow. Like, northern Florida. The reach that they had, just because in the South, healthcare is so much worse. And they were so grateful. Like, I'd see so many people at Vanderbilt with their huge suitcases in the waiting room, and they go there when it's horrible, obviously. Like, once it gets to the point where you have no choice. Yeah. But, yeah, that is one of the main issues is, I mean, obviously not in Chicago, but it's in the U.S. in general, is finding access to a healthcare place. And, like, that's what, in a lot of the interviews that I was in, they talked about patient education, especially in, like, low income and low education areas. A lot of people, it's not standard to go to the doctor or know, like, things that we think are normal. Like, in so many parts of the country, it's, like, not at all that way. And
it's not even really, Mr. Flanagan, pile on wherever you want, but it's not even really, if you happen to have, it hasn't happened to me lately at all, but I mean, it's nice, but if you wander into an emergency room and you think something's wrong, because a friend of mine just happened to him. You go in there and you think maybe you're having a heart issue. Well, they give you an EKG, they check your blood pressure, and they give you that enzyme test, right? And if you're not having a heart attack, they essentially you can stay there and hack around in an emergency for 12 hours, or it'll say go see a cardiologist. Well, anybody who didn't get his degree yesterday, it's got to be a 6 to 8 week wait to see. I mean, any once you go up the ladder, any kind of a special, I mean, to see an orthopedic guy, if you can walk, if you blow your knee out, they're going to keep you there and a guy will do it. But if you just happen to have a regular knee problem, good luck, 6 to 8 weeks to see somebody.
It is so difficult to get in. Yeah, and that is the hardest thing, especially that's why PAs, I guess, are helpful, because you can get in to see the PA first and then see the doctor eventually. But that is, yeah, I feel like the problem in general for medicine.
I don't think I've seen my doctor for the last 3 years. I've seen the PAs.
Yeah.
And what I've noticed is they're extremely disciplined, and they're always yelling at you because they have their method, because they're very methodology driven. And so I find them to be more thorough than an actual physician, because, every time I see my physician, I ask if he's okay, because, he looks like, the bags under his eyes, are going down to his cheeks. He's got a nervous tick because they're so stressed out and so busy.
Yeah,
and the PAs are, the PAs are okay. What didn't I tell you last time about your blood pressure medication?
Yep.
Okay, then they yell at you. So I think it's great. I mean, the quality of care I've gotten from PAs is very high.
But the problem is so hard too, because it's like, it's not like not many patients are getting seen a day. Like, especially in the practices that I worked in, this is a problem literally everywhere. It's at the end of the day a business, whether you're in a private practice or a huge academic medical center, where if you're the provider, you have like 10 minutes with the patient, maybe 15 minutes if they're a new patient, and your salary is maximized by the amount of patients you see in a day, extrapolated to a whole year. So it's like, at the end of the day, you're not incentivized cost-wise by good outcomes, but by volume of patients seen. So that's the part that a lot of people have issues with. It's like, so many doctors I talk to, they're like, if only I had more time. I'm constantly being harped on by the head of the hospital to have more business, more procedures, more whatever, but it's, I don't have enough time to see these patients. And it's, that is the part that I have the biggest problem with.
Okay, the whole idea, I mean, I'm going back, I'm saying before Katie, the big fight was between HMOs and other stuff. And HMO really was a way, I mean, Mr. Flanagan, am I correct? It's a way to essentially self-insure, like a company, say if PTI had, 200 employees, we would sign up with an HMO. So they would essentially do the general practitioner work for PTI Securities. I don't think people do this anymore, but that was the idea was, if everybody got sick here for some reason, you'd have 10, 15 minutes per patient, because if you actually had to see everybody in a regular month, no doctor had the time for it. So these HMOs became, totally distrusted, and there's probably still a few of them around, but nobody wants to admit to being an HMO. Well, now the entire medicine practice is turned into the same thing, to where, how many independent doctors do you know? I mean, they're all part of a group, and the group basically demands, they're salaried employees. I mean, when I was your age, the idea that the highest paid person in a hospital not being a doctor would have been foolish, and now they're not even close, right? I mean it's all
that. Yeah.
I mean, that's insanity. I mean, I know my doctor joined one of these groups. He couldn't even give you an EKG without the machine being hooked up to computers so they'd bill you. He used to have one, he'd just do it and look at it. I mean, you can't do anything. You can't, if you prescribe something that they don't like because you're older and you know something else that works, they don't want that. You have to prescribe what they want. I mean, somehow this rigorousness of these companies, to me, it's worse than the old HMO, which everybody hated. Or where am I wrong here?
Yeah, it is becoming so corrupt. I mean, it obviously depends on who you're going with, but I worked at an ENT clinic in Nashville, and we had one doctor who was known for, even if you didn't have symptoms, he would still give you a scope and charge you like $500+ for this, and it would get me so aggravated. Like, I would rebel against him and like know that he wanted to set them up for a scope, but I would be like, they don't have these symptoms. Clinically, they don't need a scope, and, like, no other doctor in the practice would do this, but he would always say, oh, it never hurts to look, just, like, hinting at the fact that he wanted more money. And it's just so crazy to me that patients are just left in the dark because they aren't educated on, like, what's normal and standard for practice, but then you see this happening, and it's okay because he's a part owner of this practice, and he's making a ton of money, but then it's a bunch of patients are getting unnecessary procedures, which I'm not saying this is everywhere, but that's why I personally will not work at a private practice, because I've seen it happen too much in, like, private practice settings. But it is just so insane. And that's definitely not everyone, but it's crazy the power that some of these people have, that they just, like, totally...
One of my friends, who's... real quick, John, I know, is,
yeah, sure.
He was going to a medical school at the late Michael Reese, right? And he said, you know, you're one of these old-time doctors. You have to, now you think you have to have somebody sit down and write down all the symptoms and somebody do this big interview. Because those guys, they would watch you walk from the waiting room. They would look at your face, see your color, and see you sit down. They could tell you what was wrong with you. You didn't have to tell them. I mean, is that skill gone? I mean, or is it some people have it and they don't get to use it or what? He goes, they could tell right away. They tell you you were sick or what was wrong with you. That's what those guys knew how to do. But does anybody do that anymore?
I don't think it's gone. I think just after working with so many doctors, they know that if they go the extra mile there and spend more time with the patient, then they're behind for, like, the rest of the day. And, like, it's almost like you have to take, like, a calculated sacrifice. Like, okay, this patient needs more time, but now... And I've seen this happen so many times. And now I'm going to be 30 minutes to 2 hours behind the whole day, and then my staff will get super mad at me. And if you consistently do this, that's something that you get heat for in your practice. But the doctor that I worked with did consistently do this, but his patients loved him. And he is such an amazing surgeon, and he made sure that he was so meticulous with his patients and that he thoroughly knew them, thoroughly knew their issue. And he would get, at the end of the day, a lot of heat from the people that we worked with because other people were inconvenienced because of this. But that's someone that I respect, because then his patients had such good results. So it's still there.
Well, what's Katie, go ahead, John.
I'm wondering, you know, my perception of the research end of medicine, and I'd like your perspective on this, is that when it comes to competing for, you know, grant money or whatever, that a lot of the agencies, companies, whatever, that have money to give to projects are interested in the therapy possibilities of this. So they've got an idea if at some, you know, treatment, drug, whatever, that we have, you know, research about, if we could find an application for this in area A, B, C, or whatever, we will fund research in areas A, B, C, with the idea that there is, you know, then, you know, a possible dependency for the particular, you know, drug that we could develop and we have a patent on. And I guess it's you know, the difference or the struggle between applied research and just pure research, where there really isn't any pure research in the field anymore, because the only way you can, you know, prove your worthiness to get grant money is if there is some, you know, need for this in a particular direction, a particular therapy, or some other kind of, you know, chain of events where somebody's willing to make an investment in research to achieve that result and get that kind of, you know, profit. So do you see that the you know, selection process for grant money, does it start way back in the chain for the people who or the companies that are interested in how much money we can make on, you know, this? It should pan out this way, as opposed to just getting information that may or may not be applicable to anything we have in our back pocket, but that may be useful to somebody somewhere down the road if these results get published some way. So I'm wondering how much of it is controlled by, like, the pharmaceutical industry, as opposed to research institutes that are just looking for information, and maybe we don't have a use yet for that information.
Yeah, so I think what you're describing there is just the core difference between academic research and big pharma. So yeah, if you want the money, it's in big pharma, and that depends more on, like, what's kind of what you're saying, like, the new product we're chasing, like, the end goal, mostly, but that's why a lot of people who have more, like, pure intentions, I guess to say, and are there for, I don't want to say the greater good, because every research is technically contributing to, like, advancing some type of research, but yeah, I do see in academic research, it's more for, like, any chance of any idea that's beneficial towards research you get rewarded for, where in big pharma, it's more about, like, okay, are we creating a product that we can translate to use now in research and benefit financially from this now, where I worked in a lot of research areas where, and I was working on, like, spinocerebellar ataxia, where the ideas that we came up with were super helpful, and eventually that it was wet lab research it showed, like, what part of the cell was contributing to the disease, and it was super impactful. But, like, if you're looking at that as a layperson in the grand scheme of things, you may not realize how important that is, but it's, like, that is so necessary for the next step. So maybe in, like, 20 years, a big pharmaceutical company will see this idea that we've developed so long ago and be able to develop a product off of it. But it just
Katie, expand on that a little bit, because it's kind of an orphan disease, right, you're working in?
What do you mean by
that?
Well,
I mean, not a whole lot of people have it, so.
Oh, yes, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So you guys, why don't you expand on that a little bit? Because I found it very interesting, and people probably forgot when you said it once before. So it's a symptom that not many people have, and you guys did some fundamental research, and you found some gene screw-up, basically. But to go to the gene therapy and stuff for that many people probably is not profitable. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, so it's spinocerebellar ataxia, and it's a neurodegenerative disease that's caused by, like, in the specific gene, it's a CAG repeat, so you have, like, a ton of these repeats, you're symptomatically worse, which is the same as Huntington's disease. So it's, like, even though it's a small and rare neurodegenerative disease, what we found is applicable to, like, Huntington's and neurodegenerative diseases like that. But yeah, basically, people knew, like, what the disease was and, like, genetically what marked the disease, but then what we found is that what made it better and improved symptoms, we did this in mice, was that restricting this specific sequence that moved the protein to the nucleus made, so we, like, genetically engineered these mice, made symptoms significantly better, and you lived longer in mice. So basically that tells you is that you need a medication that targets this protein and restricts it from the nucleus. So that's not, like, in our research, but it's, like, that suggests that that is, like, a therapeutic mechanism that will help this disease. And again, this starts in mice, but you can't start in humans. So yeah, it's, I mean, it was a huge discovery, but it's, like, it's not like we have products in people yet, which some people may, like, frown upon, but it's still, like, huge. And that's what, in academic research, they acknowledge that. And we got so many benefits from that. And the principal investigator of that study is very wealthy because he had these huge breakthroughs that academic research rewards him for. So it is nice to see, like, that celebrated, but yeah, it's considered slower.
Well, it kind of hits something like that. It's kind of close to home for myself and Mr. Flanagan because our coach, our football coach, Eric Parsegian, spent the latter part of his life. Was it two kids and three grandkids, John? It was some whole family thing where there was a gene, that spinal gene, that followed. When you were giving the story the first time, all I was thinking about was him. And they... John, it followed, like, several generations, right, in his family, and these people were dying.
Yes.
And
yes.
But he raised a whole bunch of money for it, Katie. Now, okay, mm-hmm. but he, you know, he was a national celebrity. He's a really terrific guy. All right, so he raises $50 million. What does he even do with it? How does he find somebody who's zeroes in on that particular thing? Or there probably is somebody somewhere, maybe. But how does that even work? How does the money find the right guy?
I don't know how that entirely works, but I do know that our lab that I worked in was based on someone who had spinocerebellar ataxia, and their family gave so much money to start this lab. And
okay.
So that's what, that's how we started. It's like the Bob Allison Ataxia Research Center. And so that's what keeps it going. But yeah, you just have to find those people, which is hard, because I know there's one in like Minnesota, and then there's one in Texas at Baylor, I think. And then besides that, I'm not sure if there are other ones. But yeah, that's why it is helpful when those people do make those types of donations.
Okay, is there any connection that you know of? Because, I mean, obviously we were at the thing Friday night with Diane. Is there any connection? Who does the research for, or is there stuff that affects veterans? Is that a specific sort of thing? I mean, because those guys sometimes come back to places with diseases and even mental stuff. Does anybody, is that just, they just kind of swoop along with everybody else, or, does, or do people take care of issues that kind of specifically relate to veterans? And I'm sure there are some.
Yeah, they do have their own research, definitely. Yeah, like I got a job offer to do research at Stanford, actually, for veterans, for like PTSD and stuff. So yeah, it is like specific to veterans, because I know a lot of those patients, like, they're so complex and they have so many overlapping problems, so like it's hard to integrate them into like regular research, just because like there's typically a lot going on there. So yeah, they usually have their own.
We did a thing here for probably Mr. Flanagan. How long was it? Was it like 10 days? We did stuff on, we had psychologists, we had people that were raising money for we had Diana on a couple of times. It was all about a veterans thing and how it's funded and how its care is there or not there and stuff. We should add you on, because obviously you have some insights there as well, because it's, you, nobody really brought up the part about how they have all the same, some people have all the same problems. You know, you're missing a limb, you got PTSD, you got all kinds of other stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's a, your family deserts you a whole bit. I mean, have you actually done any work in a veterans facility?
No, I haven't actually. We had some of our participants when I was at Vanderbilt who were veterans, but even if they like wanted to be in the study, a lot of times we would, because you couldn't have PTSD for our study, so a lot of times we'd get veterans in who like wanted to participate, but then they had PTSD, so then they couldn't, which I feel like is like a common issue, because there's so many, like, veterans are just so complex compared, like, medically complex compared to like the regular population. So
why would, if it was a, just out of curiosity, why would that disqualify somebody?
Because it's just like another variable.
Okay.
For research. So it's, that's why a lot of times, like, when enrolling people, you have to meet a certain criteria, and there's some conditions that you can't have. So like, say you're doing a psych based study or like neuro study, and we were focusing on like depression and memory, but then if you have PTSD, that's like a factor that could really affect the test results, and another variable that could construe the results. So it's like, to make it more,
so if John Flanagan or John Lee wanted to get one of these studies, you just kick them right out, say they're not qualified.
Yeah. No, it's sad. It is sad, because you want to help them, but
they need help. John, Mr. Flanagan, you sound like you have some questions. Well, I've been, I'm talking too much.
Well, I'm, Katie, I'm an English teacher, so I don't have any medical expertise really whatsoever. But when I teach a research class in like English Comp 102, you know, on exploring, you know, some subject area with the idea of digging in and finding out what's been said about this, the you know, the guidebooks, you know, for the students and for the teachers is always like setting up a range of questions where you would ask, you know, I want to know XYZ in order to do something in the area of ABC, because mm-hmm. ultimately I want to find, you know, some other variable at the end. There's always like a three-step process of framing a research project, so that you would, you know, always have some reminder of why you're looking into, you know, published materials at all, or which kinds of materials. And I'm just wondering how much freedom researchers have today to just pose questions even in an academic environment, as opposed to, you know, someone who's actually there because you're trying to make a connection with something that already exists and, you know, or maybe a pharmaceutical, you know, company's product that has applications in a lot of other diseases, and we want to find out what those diseases are. Can you really just, you know, have a research topic that, you know, I guess you can do whatever you want on your own time, but if you're asking somebody to help you with materials and lab space and stuff, can you really do research that's just, you know, open-ended, as opposed to something that really has already a destination in mind?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I feel like it's a matter of clinical research that's, like, distinctive. So anything involving patients or, like, animal research, too, for, like, human diseases, there's such a concern for ethics that they want questions that are, like, exactly what you were saying. That was, like, such a good comparison with you're wondering ABC and to find out the next step. Like, everything has to be so operationalized and already, like, evidence-based. So, like, the studies that we were doing on the mice, since there's mice involved and a lot of ethic rules, that had to be based on a previous study that showed that because this study was done, this study is likely to be successful. However, we don't know. We have this main research question that we don't know the answer to, but basically you've had a lot of other successful research questions answered using similar logic. So it's like, in a way, you don't have as much freedom because of, like, the ethics involved, especially in, like, clinical research, too. By the time it makes it to humans, like, it really does have to be, like, extremely scrutinized and thoroughly based off of previous research, kind of snowballing. But, like, for example, I also currently do research for this neuroaesthetics lab, and it's super random, and it doesn't involve patients, so, like, we can do whatever we want, and, like, we really can just come up with any question. And a lot of times when I'm in the research, I'm like, the results don't really matter. Like, they're more interesting. Like, we're doing the stuff on, like, social aesthetics and, like, what people like and why. And, like, we don't have any limits to that because we're not, like, subjecting people to, like, a medical manipulation. So it just depends on, like,
well, you're not killing the poor mouse either.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah, genetically engineering these, like, ataxic mice who are, like, can barely walk.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. There is some, if it's, I suppose it's for the good, I wouldn't want to do it, but I suppose if it's for the good, I could pull it off. But if I didn't know what I was doing, I wouldn't just be, I don't even want to kill mice.
Yeah, no, it's sad. It is, yeah. Actually really sad, but it's, like, super helpful. But then it is, like, especially once you see, like, I feel like research in monkeys more hits home, like, a lot of, because they have obviously less harsh rules than humans. But then, like, I worked with a guy who worked with these monkeys that are so human-like, and they would be, like, killing them after these studies, and he would be, like, crying in the lab, and, like, it's, like, it's helpful, but it's so sad, too, sometimes.
Yeah, I'd be, I get this feeling, I don't even know I could put the question up there, and in a lot of ways, we're making these, I'll give you an example. I mean, as you age, you have a lot of people that are friends of yours that have medical issues. I mean, it's just part of the game, right? I mean, I see the commercials for, like, Northwestern, because that's obviously close to downtown here, and, well, it's in downtown. And you see the incredible advancements they make that they put on commercials, you know, double lung this and, you know, God knows what they're. And yet everybody, not everybody, but a lot of people that I know that have gone in there, a lady in the neighborhood I talked to the other night, had open heart, well, she had a valve problem, and they opened up her chest and the whole thing. And I don't know how long she was in there, but she says the communication is terrible. When you leave, there's not even really, like, a phone number for you to call if there's a problem. They won't let your regular doctor even in the place, which that part I understand. But and on one hand, it seems like we're gaining, yet in terms of access and in terms of communication and people, I mean, I knew one person who was in there, and he's passed 10, 11 days. He came out without a conclusion. He didn't even know who to talk to. I mean, to call up and say, what did you guys do for 10 days? I mean, it seems like we're gaining in one area and we're losing in another. Am I just being a cynic here, or is there some semblance to what I'm saying?
I get what you're saying. I feel like being on the other side of it, it's hard because, like, you I mean, you should be explaining all this to patients and then, like, being like, oh, you can call this number, whatever, if you have any questions. And, I mean, not to put this out there, but, like, I've seen it happen so many times to patients, and obviously you have a lot going on in the room, like, it's super stressful. Like, a lot of times I see the same things being said over and over again, and, like, people just, like, don't remember. And, like, I feel like that sounds awful saying that, but sometimes there's so much information being relayed, which it probably could be relayed in a better way, but a lot of people don't remember, especially if you're, like, older, or, like, now everything's done on, like, my chart. So I feel like a lot of younger people have an easier time communicating that way, but then it, like, is hard for people who aren't as good with technology, like, because that's now the main way of communication, but someone who's, like, 85 years old can't really get on their phone and log on to the my chart. So I feel like that is hard, because it's, I think it's just like a generational thing where people are having.
Why? I mean, I was joking with this, not joking, but she was saying some simple stuff like, you know, they pump so much water into you in open heart surgery that chances are the shoes you came in with aren't going to fit. Go leave it. You know, I said, why don't they just have a piece of paper, a chart, where they give you 10, I mean, no pilot gets on a plane without picking out his checklist and rattling it off. I mean, why can't there be 10 things to remember when you leave after this kind of surgery and just hand it to you? I mean, it's...
Well, I actually just had surgery at Northwestern, and I got something exactly like that. Yeah.
But you're kind of an educated patient.
That is true, yeah. I don't know. That is the difficult part, and it's hard because a lot of times, like, I worked as a medical assistant, and so these doctors are doing the surgery, and then they're, like, depending on the medical assistants or nurses then to, like, do all of this. So I feel like somewhere down the line, it gets lost a lot of times, which, like, then the doctors will tell you, because they're technically not required to do that. I was just talking about my sister who just graduated nursing school, and she's like, that's the nurse's role. Like, they're the ones who are responsible for patient education and doing those types of things. Like, doctors and PAs and stuff are not legally required to. So I feel like it's hard because that is...
Well, I mean, I'm with you. But she told me that she probably saw the surgeon before and after a total of 5 minutes. Now, I don't think it needs to be an hour. You're right. But I'm going to say five's a little short.
Yeah, no, definitely.
I mean, it could have been 10 or 20. I mean, I don't know enough. That's what I'm asking you. I don't know. It seems to me, from what people are relating to me, that we've gone maybe a little too far the other way. I mean, the doctor doesn't have to hold your hand and give you an hour-long... I mean, it's not... You know, come on. I get that part, because he should be doing another surgery. But somewhere along the line, they seem like they're... You know, they're like the cowboy. I did my job. Now everybody else... don't even ask me about how bad you feel the next day. It's not my job. And, you know, it seems like we're going a little too far, that, or at least what I'm saying. So, I don't know, just...
Yeah, no, I do agree. And I feel like, after seeing all these people, like, working, it's like you have your OR days and then you have your clinic days, and, like, OR days are meant for surgery. And I feel like it is just, like, a time thing. Like, people now, it's like, I'm doing 7 surgeries in a day. Like, do they have time to, like, go to the room after, when the patient's in the hospital after, to, like, talk to them? It's like, like, personally for me, my doctor did talk to me for a while, but it is just, like, honestly dependent on the doctor and, like, their time, which is sad. But now is, like, they want to crank more and more surgeries out in one day. Like, you could be in there for so long as a doctor, and then the next day you have to do clinic, and then you have, like, 20 to 40 patients in a day with, like, 10-minute slots. So I feel like it just gets back to the same thing. It's like the doctors are wanting to have this type of patient interaction, but their schedule and, like, what they're being pressured
from. But who makes... We got a Dash and Audrey's going to be calling in about real estate in a bit. We want to have you back. But when you say, who's the they? Are all these people, are they all employed by the hospital?
Yeah, it's, like, hospital administration and, like, the financial people of the hospital seeing, like, we have X amount of patients coming in, they're seen for X amount of minutes, how many billables do we have per patient slot, and basically, like, how time is being equated to billables and procedures, and they're basically wanting to maximize the efficiency for, like,
Well, Mr. Flanagan and Mr. Lee, if you're still there, did you just get a shiver up your spine when somebody in the accounting department is telling the surgeon how long he spends with his patient? I did.
It's ridiculous.
But it's like, who's that? And I bet he makes more than a doctor.
Yeah, and doctors hate it. They're constantly fighting this, and it's like, I feel like it's the medical providers get the bad rep, but it's really a reflection of the pressures they're put on by the hospital administration, and especially then the ethics get really blurred, especially when you're working in a private practice, when you're the physician, but you're also managing the financials of the practice. And I feel like that's when your motives, like the guy I was talking about earlier who did unethical procedures, it's like, then your motives start to be money over patient care because you're also managing patients plus the financials and success of the practice. So it's just, it's money really taints medicine, even when those who go in it.
You'd say that it taints most everything.
Yeah, you know, it does.
Well, hey, you're going to come back before you go to school, aren't you? Will I have you on at least again?
Yeah, I'll come back again. Thank you.
I mean,
congratulations on your upcoming appointment, too. That's great.
Thank you so much.
I'll give you a piece of trivia regarding your school. Mr. Flanagan probably doesn't know this. Mr. Lee, I'm sure doesn't. Name it a school that has the most national football titles to their name.
Name the school?
Yeah. If you go back far enough, that would be Yale.
Really?
Yep.
Well, how far back?
If you start whenever football started, 1890 or whatever, they've got way more than anybody else. If you start at like 1910, then they don't. But it's a trivia question.
Probably about the University of Chicago too.
They stopped playing in the 20s, right, or 30s.
Yeah.
They have a team now. Katie, when I went there, my first year of business school, the football team's working out, right? You know, I was a pretty big guy. All of a sudden, they're doing jogging around the field. And after coming from Notre Dame, I see these guys and I go, there's only one guy there bigger than me. they can't have much of a team. And oh, by the way, they didn't. They scored a touchdown in their first quarter of the first game and a touchdown in the last quarter of the last game. The rest of the season, they were skunked. That's how bad
they
were.
I'm not surprised.
But now they've gotten a little bit better. They play like Augustana, and they play in those kinds of leagues.
Yeah.
And they're Yale, I think, still plays somebody. They play in the Ivy League. But anyway, when are you actually leaving? So when do we have to squeeze you back by?
Like, I'm leaving the end of July.
Oh, so we got time. You'll be on a couple more times.
Yeah, I have some time.
I think with Mr. Flanagan and I, Monday is the day because John and I are both very interested in this. Can I talk for you there, Mr. Flanagan?
Yep.
So, Katie, you take care. John, you can hang around for Audrey.
Sure.
S&P Futures down 5. NASDAQ Futures down 25. We're going to do a quick market wrap up, and then we'll have Audrey on.
Well, thank you so much.
Hello, this is Tom Allen, Chief. Thank you. Like most of you know that I'm also the Chief Investment Officer at PTI Securities and Futures. There we invest for and help a wide variety of clients. And you know what? No two are the same. Some have legacy stocks, some concentration issues, some maybe embedded tax issues. The others might need or want some portfolio protection. There could be estate issues or maybe new family members. The point is that we are all unique and the portfolios should match. However, the last several years have seen a relatively one-way market. It seemed that all we needed was to be all in. No protection, no fixed income, just be all in, no matter who you are, what your risk profile or age. Most management firms love that. Take this and like it, no matter who you are. Be careful with that. You are not everybody. I think most see the market view going forward as maybe different than the one looking back, so your portfolio should reflect that. Maybe it's just as simple as your life station has changed. Towards that end, we are accepting some new clients needing a more personal approach and are interested in negotiating the future and not with a portfolio designed for the past. Find me at 312-663-4310. That's 312-663-4310.
Hi, I'm Audrey Johnson, an owner of Home Source Realty and a frequent contributor to Stocks and Jocks. If you're nervous about the stock market and considering diversification, or are looking for a rate of return way better than your banks, consider adding rental properties to your portfolio. Whether it's a condo, single family, or multi-unit building, I can help you select a property that meets your financial needs. Call or text me at 708-349 7083456. That's 7083493456. Or visit my website at myhomesourcerealty.com. That's myhomesourcerealty.com.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Here. Right now. Right here. Right now. Right now.
Round up the usual suspects.
Well, welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. We had a little bit of a pause there. S&P futures down 6. NASDAQ futures down 31. Dow futures down 34. Real quick over in Europe. DAX down 111.5%. FTSE up to, say flat, CAC around 93. Well, it's been bizarre lately. The FTSE, whatever, the other guys are down, they want to be up. When they're up, the other guys are down. It's kind of weird what they're doing. Asia, they get down 295.5%. Hang Seng up 13, call that flat. Shanghai up 45, that's a full 1%. Bonds up 2 base points, 4.38. We've got oil up 252, pushing towards 100 again, 97.94. RBOB 360. So again, that equates to probably 450, 440, 460, depending on the state you're in, which is right where it is. A gold down 33, 46, 97. Silver up 248. That's a 3% move in silver. That's 83.35. Foreign exchange, the dollar's actually stronger today, but still, the euro was strong last week, almost 118. British pound 136. So the dollar's still down from like a week and a half ago. Crypto down 182 to 81,218. Matt, your machine frozen over there?
Yeah, well, it's working now. But, yeah, a second ago we were thick as ice, frozen solid.
Well, you know, what did you do? You must have, were you touching an outlet and touching a board at the same time or something?
I smacked it a couple times and it started.
Oh, Jimmy didn't walk by, did he? That's enough to break it.
That'll do it, yeah.
That'll do it. Well, do we have Audrey?
We do indeed, yeah.
Hey, Audrey, how are you? A little late because we had the lovely Katie on. Boy, she's a delight.
I was listening to Katie. It was wonderful. She's very, very bright and intelligent. She's going to have a wonderful future. She's a lovely, lovely person also. I can vouch for that. Watched her grow up, and she's turned into a great person. She'd be a great contributor to the world.
I think so. And she's got a younger sister who is very nice as well, and we'll even put up with her aunt, Kathy.
Don't you say bad things about my darling friend.
Oh, boy. What, is Kathy love those girls or what? For God's sake.
Oh, my God. All her nieces and nephews.
Yep.
Absolutely. Loves them dearly. But, yeah, all of a sudden I didn't hear any noise. I thought you guys decided to go off for breakfast or something for a minute.
We're not sure. We're not sure what Matt Byrne did over there. Of course, the board's older than me, so that's a problem. But
that happens. But, hey, why don't you blame it all on Matt? Maybe you touched something.
Well, I saw Jimmy walk by out there, so that's always a possibility.
I'll take the blame. Don't worry about it.
Matt says he'll take the blame. So, Odd, what's going on in your world? Do you have any follow-up questions that we maybe should ask Katie?
And we were, you know, I only caught a few minutes of it, but it's, you know, what she said is, I think it's very just indicative of, unfortunately, I think the biggest mistake that ever happened to medicine was basically turning hospitals into chain stores.
Yeah.
It made it almost impossible for doctors to have a solo practice, and the pressure that they put on them, it's awful. I mean, all you are is a money-making machine, and the administrators do make more money than the doctors. I wouldn't care about if Medicare care was expensive if it went to the doctors and nurses and the technicians who actually take care of you. Again, It's the middleman. It's the bureaucrats sitting in the middle, and the people who own all the chains. I call them chains. That's all they are. It's like a chain restaurant. These are chain hospitals, and it's all about profit. And so they're slotted in. I have a doctor I love dearly that took care of me. He was an ENT for 20 years. He and his dad. Great. I had some ear problems when I was younger. Unbelievably wonderful doctor and human being. And they had their own practice. And when the dad retired and the son took it over, it was so difficult. And the hospitals kept pushing him more and more. The administrative and the insurance filings and the hoops you have to jump through to get a patient in to be seen and approved. Doctors spent half their time and our staff calling around insurance companies going, hey, my patient needs A-B test and you're not approving him and this is why he should be approved. Same thing with who pays for what drugs. They have to call and say, and this is all eating time out of their day. So all of the BS paperwork is destroying our medical care system and the greed for money from the owner of the chain hospitals.
Well, I think it's incredible, and my suspicious mind, Jen, leads me to believe that the insurance companies charge the individual people more than they should to drive them toward the hospitals.
Of course,
which A is illegal and B really sucks. But what is illegal anymore? Everything's illegal. Nobody pays any attention to any of that stuff. But hey, what's going on in the real estate world, Ud? Tell us about that. And Jen, you're more of a real estate guy. You ask the questions.
Sure.
You know what? It's busy. It's spring seasons and full swing here. Housing market is, I think last week, listings were up year over year by like 13%. The amount of, and prices are up also, which is no surprise to anybody, but we are back in full swing. Listings under contract, yeah, we're up, I think, about 13 or 14%. So, again, you're seeing this upswing. New household formation. It's still, what's a big driver of the market is still the boomers because they're not as affected by the price increases. They benefited from all the price increases and the equity that they've had their home. Maybe they've been there for 10, 20, let's say 20, 30, 40, 50 years.
Yeah,
and they can take that little bungalow that they paid $18,000 for and turn around and sell it for $450 or whatever. So that's happening. But do you have household formation and your Gen Zers are coming along? They're doing some stuff, maybe a little more than the millennials, according to some of the information I've seen coming across. But it's busy out my way. Houses are moving. Again, it's got to be nice. If you've got a nice house, but if you're thinking about selling, prep that house so you have good curb appeal. Make it as neat and clean and nice as you can, even if you're just putting a fresh coat of paint on, a few little simple things, change the knobs on your cabinets, brighten things up. If everything's clean and neat, you're still going to get a good price for it. So make sure you do your homework. Ask your realtor. Go online. You can get tips on how to make your house shine and look better than everybody else's. And it starts with when they pull up in front of the house and look at it and go, could I live there? And if the answer is yes, when they come in the door, you've already ahead of the game.
Well, and what I know you, sorry, John, I'm going to ask one question and then it's all yours. But we mentioned your name the other day on the show. When you're involved in a lot of these bidding wars for these houses and you have a clientele list that, it's usually somebody in their family, somebody you've done business before. I mean, I'll show my age and say your Rolodex is huge. And I'm going to say, even though I really don't, probably know isn't any of your business, the last 8 out of 10 sales have been cash sales from people, just like you described, that have money trading up, trading down, that kind of thing. But they're basically trading like an option. They're trading houses. What if it wasn't? What if your business was all kind of new people looking to? I mean, I don't see a guy and his wife that are 28 years old outbidding one of the people that you have bidding on these houses. I mean, I don't see that happening. I mean, How much of a bifurcation is there between the people who, quote, have money and people who don't?
You know what? It's two completely separate markets.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah.
So they're not looking at the same thing. But yes, I've had two first-time buyers so far this year that were bidding worse, and they knew it going in, because all the other first-time buyers, it might not be as giant of a pool, but it doesn't matter if 10 people want the same house. You're still getting that bidding work.
Well,
Audrey, I've noticed, you know, in my neighborhood around me, I've seen a couple big price drops on properties that haven't been on the market very long, and yet they apparently have realized they're not getting any nibbles, and there's been a precipitous drop in the price. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about your job in coming up with a listing price and the kind of pushback you get from clients for whatever reason, that they think their house is worth a lot more than the average person thinks it is, and you've got to kind of steer them down a path that, you know, paints a more realistic picture. How is that one of the more difficult aspects of your job, is hitting that price and getting a good one so that you don't, you know, start to look, make the property look like a white elephant on the market by sitting there too long? It's kind of a difficult
task. You're absolutely right. And pricing a house accurately in this market, you really have to know what you're doing so you can best serve your client. And things change so rapidly, you have to stay involved. But again, you're looking at the price, condition, homes in the neighborhood. Is it a desirable type of house, you know, for that? Is that what the people are buying there? And the problem is, but what happens in the real estate world sometimes, and it's good for the public to be aware of this, is a lot of times if the people will interview several real estate agents, as they should, because you, as far as a real estate agent goes, I think it's almost like a doctor relationship. If you hire a real estate agent, say if you hire me, I'm in your life for however long it takes, whether you're buying or selling a house. So you and I are sharing financial details. Maybe, you know, buying a house or selling is emotional. So we're sharing, you know, interactions with finance, mental, emotional, everything that's involved in making this purchase. So it has to be a good fit. Okay, so you're finding the right person. So you're interviewing this agent. And where sometimes it comes along as, it's like anything else. Sometimes you run into the person in any field who tells you what you want to hear. Okay. Yes, your house is worth $1 billion more than the one next door to you, even though it's not true. Now, in the business, we call that buying the listing. We're going to, you know, say it's worth this much money. Oh, no, I think it's worth this much money, and I can get it for you. And, you know, it happens. And what happens is people, okay, I want to make that much money. And then down the road, there's no showings. The agent goes, oh, you know what, we got to lower that price. It's not going to sell at that price. The people are like, what do you mean? You said it would. But then they're locked in, they're going. So people have to be aware. If one person, if you interview three or four agents, and one agent's got this huge discrepancy, before you jump on that, you could do a little of your own homework online. And most buyers and sellers have been sophisticated enough for years that they've used the internet to get a feel for the market before they talk to anybody. I would say 99.9% of the world is on the internet looking at houses, okay? As well they should be. All information is good. So that's the basic problem, is that you've got to make sure that you're getting an accurate representation of price. So it's like the highest offer isn't necessarily the most accurate offer. I'm not saying it can't always be, but like anything out, check it out and see the reasons behind whatever agent you interview. Why are they giving you this price? Can they back up what they say? You know, ask for comps. Say, well, what's sold in my neighborhood? Don't be afraid to ask for information. You're trusting this person, you know, with basically your financial future in a way. So ask questions and don't just jump on something. So to your point, John, that could be, you know, sometimes things are honestly overpriced. It happens. We all make mistakes. None of us are perfect. But be aware that if somebody's telling you in a $300,000 neighborhood that the house is worth $450,000, that should give you a little pause just to say, well, why do you think that?
What would motivate
Yeah, that might be why this is how these houses are happening.
But that seems to me to be such a, for those that don't know the business, if Aud gets a listing, she's paying for the advertisement. She's paying for the pictures. If it's a nice piece of property and you have a drone guy, she's paying for the drone. Why would anybody on your side, if you knew the place was worth $500 and you listed for $9 and you're not going to sell it, you're out of pocket money. What would possess you to do that?
Well, what they're hoping is a lot of them tie clients, and this is good, I tell clients, you go to list your house, you're signing a legal contract, and a lot of agents like to, and or are told to by their managers, sign these people up for 6 months, sign these people up for a year. I myself tend to ask for a shorter period of time. A, it's more comfortable for the person, you know, I have 90 days, something like that, whatever I think we're both comfortable with. And I also tell people up front, that's like, this is the contract you're signing with me. But if you're ever unhappy with me, I want you to tell me, and I would release you. Now, most of these places will not release you without a fight. Say you're not happy, you come with they're doing a job, or you have, you know, that you just can't say, I don't want to work with you anymore once you sign that document. So they're hoping that if they tie you up long enough, they're going to wear you down, and they'll come back to you for a price reduction. Oh, it still won't sell. You got to bring the price down. So in 60, 90 days, you've just gotten beaten up enough that you've lowered your price that $100,000 just because you need to sell where the market's truly at.
Well, so if you sign up one of these guys for a year and they come back and you say, wait a minute, those pictures suck. I wouldn't buy my own place with those things. You're stuck for a year?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. Is once you sign up, it's like any other contract. So, again, and people, I've seen pictures online that I just shake my head because, you know, when you, for anybody who's going to sell your house, when you're going to sell your house, look at that listing. Check the writing. You know, nothing makes me crazier than, because I was an English minor, is that I see everything is misspelled. Now, there's no excuse for that in today's world.
No.
There's spell check on everything. I looked at one description of a $700,000 house that had pictures of open toilet bowls in the bathroom, which nobody needs to see, close to see. That's just my personal pet peeve. You're supposed to make everything look nice. And I would say, I could tell you exactly, there were 11 misspellings in 10 sentences. It was so bad, I wanted to show, give a handout to a client about this house, and I had called and said, I can't give this to anybody. They're going to think I'm this stupid. Can you change this, can correct the spelling?
So, yeah, it's stuff like that accounts for a great deal to me.
If you're listing online, don't trust. Look at it and if you, as if you were a buyer. Is this a good enough representation of my property that somebody's going to come and look at it? And don't be afraid to ask. You're paying good money for that.
John Fireway, hey, I don't want to ruin your day, Aud, but I heard a commercial driving home.
Go ahead.
I heard a commercial driving home last night. Some outfit, your listing is valuable. We will pay you for your listing. What is that all about?
Well, you know, everybody's got a gimmick, and nothing is free. Everything is built in. I won't even go into how they do it, but it's just like anything else. So it's a whole buyer beware thing. You know, you get what you pay for, no matter what it is. And everybody gets paid in the long run, no matter how it's packaged.
And I have had experiences personally with, if you have an institutional realtor, they, you know, they're not maybe going to be upfront or as upfront as you would be or somebody else would be about what this house is really worth, but they'll strike a number and, you know, there won't be any takers on it. But in the meantime, that institutional realtor has a for sale sign with their name and phone number on somebody's front lawn, and that's advertising for the firm. So that even if that house isn't selling, they're getting, you know, maybe something's jogging somebody's mind. They see that broker's name on enough places in a certain area. They begin to think, gee, I'll call that person up and see what they have to say. So
well, that's exactly why I put signs up, John. You got it. That's it.
Yeah, it's a self-perpetuating thing. They get business out of it anyway.
Absolutely.
Well, plus if you had a girlfriend who was in the business and the ground's ever frozen, it's your job to get the sign on the ground.
Yeah. Gotta have goods for something here. Yeah, I have the big rubber sledgehammer and everything that a lot of times I'll be out there and slam it away to get it in or out of the ground.
Jan, what is there a difference, you think, between what's going on in the city and the burbs? You think the taxes are part of that, Jan, or not?
Well, Audrey will know the suburbs a lot better than I do. I can see, I mean, the taxes are having a taxes and insurance. Maybe insurance is the big variable here for a lot of people, because that's a new, you know, factor that people are not used to taking into consideration when they're looking at affordability issues. And it's kind of, you know, a much more unpredictable number these days even than taxes. So I can see that taking a toll on activity around me, because people talk about what their insurance bills are coming out. You know, ours is going to come out. You know, it's a lot more than it was last year. So I'm just, you know, thinking that that's a common factor everywhere. But the suburbs, I mean, I think the suburbs probably have a healthier market now than the city does, just because the suburbs still have some, you know, decent schools and amenities that the city never could offer, and the schools are now a deterrent to, you know, people looking in the city for homes. So I think you're probably, you know, doing better in the suburbs than you could ever do in the city right now.
Jan, explain, because Audrey's talked about it a couple times, you were just at a shindig, and actually you showed up, which I was surprised, out in Park Forest or someplace, weren't you? Or in Olympia Fields?
Flossmoor? Yeah, I was in Flossmoor.
Now, what, I mean, Audrey's mentioned, what is the phenomenon with the south suburbs and the taxes being so bizarrely high compared to the housing prices that it's, is there any place like that, or are they unique in that?
I think, you know, it's just, I mean, I'm speaking of Flossmoor, because, you know, I know that area and have known people who've lived there for a while, but it doesn't have industry. It doesn't really have a commercial strip, you know, of any kind. I mean, the downtown area in Flossmoor is utterly charming, but it is not like the downtown area of Homewood, just, you know, looking at a nearby suburb. And as a result, the burden of services and a school system that's very expensive, you know, administratively, faculty-wise, everything else for Homewood and Flossmoor, there's no way you can keep that burden off of the residential market, because there's nobody else to pin it on. Other suburbs are better positioned in that they had, you know, retail centers or, you know, businesses or, you know, hospitals or factories or whatever that could contribute to the tax base. And Flossmoor, for all of its beauty, just, you know, it's marvelous. It's just spectacular homes, are all different and all, you know, very, very well built, and, you know, beautifully landscaped there. I hadn't been there in so long, I was really struck again driving around. But the taxes are just killers. I mean, just they're two or three times.
Well, John, if you back up the take into like the 70s, Flossmoor was the second highest priced suburb behind Kenilworth. They were hired by Metcalf and everything else. Not anymore.
And amenities, you know, it's golf courses and parks, I couldn't afford to live there. Their taxes are two and three times what I'm paying in the city for a two-unit building.
Well, Nancy last week said that Jan and I were on with her, and one of us said something about the rates, and she goes, an eighth or quarter point in the rate now is not the deal. First, the question I ask him is, where do you live, what are the taxes, and what's the insurance? That's kind of a new phenomenon, isn't it, Aud?
Well, it's amazing, truly, how much things have gone up. Like the taxes are, they're going to tax people right out of the state. They are. People are already leaving the state. I mean, people in Chicago, Judge, to your point, your taxes, your insurance, I cannot believe what some of my friends told me they're paying. I mean, I'm very lucky. My homeowner insurance, I believe, moved a couple hundred bucks, which I was grateful for. Okay, so I'm not complaining at all. And to your point, you're probably right about that. But I don't know how you could expect to keep and attract quality people when you're pricing them out. When the mortgage is more because of the taxes than your mortgage payment is, you got a problem.
Yep. That's a big problem. Well, what about the place you tried to sell, and you did sell in Chicago Heights, where the house was $65,000? What were the taxes? $8,000? Something like that?
Yeah, and then I showed my client a beautiful, I'll never forget this because it was so beautiful, brick three flat, octagonal front, old style, you know, like old style Chicago three flat, absolutely beautiful. $75,000 of the taxes were $14,000, and she couldn't afford it.
God,
that's really something. There's got to be some.
But that was years ago. Now,
yeah,
I would say
it's probably worse now.
5 or 6 years ago,
it's probably worse.
I know. So you know, these people who are saying them to buy a house that's reasonably priced, and these taxes. I mean, especially if people are on a fixed income, or if that two people are not anticipating a $6,000, $7,000, $10,000, you know, spike in costs, let alone the rest of the world. Yeah, and that's how people get in trouble. It's very sad. It's very upsetting. And I don't see anybody who's running for any kind of office in Illinois offering any kind of alternatives. That's what I'd love to see from anybody.
We're running over, but I got one question for you. I remember we were down in the Bahamas, and you kept telling me how much I like Conch, right? Remember me giving the speech about Micron and how the thing was going up every day and everybody in the crowd owned Micron? The same stock is doing it now. The thing is up. Since last, it's up another 38. We're not talking about real, you know, we're talking about on the first of, no, wait a minute.
Are you talking about NVIDIA?
I'm talking about Micron. I'm talking about the, Micron's
now.
The one now. It's going crazy, not NVIDIA. But Micron on April 6th was $420. Now it's $784. And there's 1,000,000,001 shares outstanding. So
well,
that's,
the market's up a ton, too.
Well, actually, there's like 10 stocks that are up. But anything now in the chip business, AMD, Intel. Intel was the sleepiest stock forever. Now, it's any of those stocks that are in the chip business are absolutely to the moon, to the point where...
Well, you've got AI, you've got chips. This is your preview of the new world. So you do have to get on board. This is the new world. This is where we're all going. And you better damn well participate. It is, whether you think they're high or not. It's our new industrial revolution.
That's what we thought in 2000 with the dot bombs, right?
What?
That's what we thought in 2000. You got to get on board, and you did. You just sometimes
I mean, we still everything's still backed up, Tim. So
yeah.
And we didn't have AI. You've got, this. I just think it's foreshadowing this new revolution of how everybody's going to live, and this is just pointing the way, I think. What do I know?
Well, I think you're probably right in a sense. It is pointing the direction. I did the same thing in 2000, John, believe it or not, which I shouldn't have. But you look around, you see how these places. When I say that the hot stocks are priced, and Aud knows, I would never say don't buy Micron, don't buy this, don't buy that. But I will say this. Can Micron double in the next 5 years if they really hit it right? Yes, they can. All I'm saying is if you look at all seven of them, they can't all double because there's not enough money in the world. That's my only... I mean, I'm never going to say which ones are which, but the idea that these companies are so friggin' big, you know, how can they... I mean, we're talking 14, 15 times revenue in some of these places now. You know, Micron is a huge company. Can they double in 3 years? They can if Intel goes out of business. Can they both double? I don't know. What do you think?
I don't see how.
Yeah, I mean, it's the numbers just seem kind of scary, but...
Well, even if they don't double, it's the rising tide lifts all boats is one thing, and they're going to go along for the ride even if it's not doubling.
Well, that's probably very true. Anyway, thank you. Good stuff as usual. Boy, it was a great show today, you and Katie. She's the back. I got to get her back on a couple times. But I hit her up with it. She didn't know that Yale has more national football champions than any other school.
Oh, God.
Well, you know,
girls
you
always need to know that stuff. Okay.
But, she was very happy to hear it.
She'd be polite to you.
Okay. She really hated us, Aud says, Jed. She didn't like us at all. Thanks for that, Aud. S&P Futures down 9. S&P Futures down 33. Hey, Jed, a lady said hello to you in the street. She really hates you. That's a great attitude. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks is brought to you by PTI Securities and Futures. Go to PTISecurities.com. PTI Pro Direct. Trade for as low as com. Home Source Realty. Call Audrey Johnson at 708-349-3456. Hamzy Analytics. Listen to Fari Hamzy every other Thursday and visit HamzyAnalytics.com. ChiroMed. Back or neck pain? Schedule a complimentary consultation by calling 708-403-2727. Dax Research. Tune in for David Andelman's technical analysis on Mondays and Thursdays and call 1-800-821-4968.
I'd stick my neck out for nobody.